Welcome to Bergenomics, demystifying economics with Ross McDowell.
Hi, I'm Ross McDowell, and welcome to Bergenomics, the podcast that demystifies economics, applying it to your life. Today's topic is your monthly budget. Is inflation about to make it explode? Every economist's nightmare is the 1930s black and white photo of a German woman stuffing her stove with banknotes to boil her kettle because inflation had made those banknotes almost worthless. Just imagine that for a second. It's like you're starting your own barbecue with $20 notes because you can't afford the inflated price of firewood. Australia's never experienced inflation at that level, but we have experienced 23.9% inflation in 1951 during the Korean War, 17.7% inflation during the 1975 OPEC oil embargoes. And now, after decades of almost no inflation, it's back. And lots of Australians are wondering how inflation will affect them. I personally have lived through inflation, which caused the interest rate on my very first home to rise from 9.1% in 1980 to 17% 10 years later. An 8% mortgage increase was a terrifying experience. So today's podcast, discussing inflation, is one that I've been waiting to have for a long time. So it's going to be fascinating for me. To demystify inflation for us today is Sherelle Murphy, Chief Economist for EY, one of the big four advisory firms operating in Australia. Prior to EY, Sherelle was Chief Economist for Austrade, helping guide Australian government policy in trade, foreign investment and tourism. Sherelle spent 15 years at the ANZ Bank after starting her career as an economic research analyst at the Reserve Bank. She's also worked as a journalist for the Australian Financial Review. Sherelle, an especially big welcome from the Bergenomics podcast to you, being our first female guest economist.
Thank you very much. It's an absolute pleasure to be here, and I hope that you can have many more female economists on in future.
I'd like to do that. Now, Sherelle, why, for literally decades, are economists so frightened by inflation?
Well, we're starting to see it pick up, as you said in your introduction. And that, of course, makes us all a bit nervous, particularly economists of my generation, because we've barely had to deal with inflation as a problem. We've been much more focused on other economic issues, and particularly employment. So this is kind of new territory for us. We're seeing it not only pick up in Australia, but also around the world. And as I'm sure your listeners would know, in the US and the UK, they're seeing multi-decade highs in the rate of inflation. It is worrying, of course, because what it does is essentially eat away at our purchasing power, and that is not desirable for anyone.
So, okay, so just tell me, what is inflation?
So inflation is essentially the movement in consumer prices. We measure it using the consumer price index, which is an index. It doesn't actually tell you anything about any one particular price. It's just an index. It revolves around 100. And what that does is it measures the quarterly changes in the price of a basket of goods and services, a fixed basket of goods and services. And that basket of goods and services is supposed to really represent the average expenditure by a household in Australia.
So does it? That would be my question.
Look, it's as good an effort as we can make. It's basically split into 11 groups, or the items which the ABS, when they're calculating this index, they group all the goods and services that we purchase as households into 11 groups. Those are split further into 87 categories, but there's actually thousands of items in there. So it's quite an extensive basket, so to speak. It's not perfect, and some people would perceive it not to reflect their prices because it doesn't include house prices. And The reason it doesn't do that is because it's essentially measuring business to consumer purchases and government to consumer. So it doesn't include consumer to consumer, if you like. So the cost of an existing house is not included. It does include the price of building a new house, though, and rents and utilities and that sort of thing. If you like, I could give you a bit of an idea of the different weights in that basket, if that would be helpful.
Yeah.
So housing is 23% of the basket. Food and non-alcoholic beverages is the next biggest category at 16%. Recreation and culture is 13%. Transport, 11%. Furniture and household equipment and services, that's 9%. And interestingly, childcare is in there because services, household services are in there. Cost of our cleaners, et cetera, would be in there. Then we have alcohol and tobacco, which is 8% of the basket. Health is 6%. Isn't that concerning that we spend more on alcohol and tobacco than we do on health? Insurance and financial services, 6%. Education, 4%. Clothing and footwear, 3%. And finally, communications at 2%. So that gives you a rough idea of how we spend. The spending categories and the weights are calculated by the ABS reflecting their household expenditure survey. So they're quite technical in how they actually come up with those weights.
Okay, so currently what's inflation running at?
So in the December quarter of 2021, which was our last CPI number, the quarterly increase in prices was 1.3%. And over the 12 months to the December quarter, the CPI rose by 3.5%. Unsurprisingly, the strongest categories in that quarter were for new dwelling purchases by owner-occupiers. So as we know, the purchase of new homes or building of new homes, and automotive fuel, which went up by 6.6%.
Okay, so if we're basing our feelings about inflation and our purchasing power on this index, if I look at, for example, you brought up fuel, if I look at petrol, in the last 12 months, petrol's risen from $1.39 a litre to a high of $2.05. That's 47%. So if a person's filling up their 60-litre fuel tank once per week, then that's costing them an extra $2,060 a year. Maybe they also have the odd steak at home. Well, that's gone up 20% in the last year. If they've done a renovation, that's gone up 20% too. It would appear that a lot of costs have gone up so quickly that that's not really being reflected well in an index that's saying, 3 to 4%.
Yeah, so you're right in the sense that there are definite categories of spending that have gone up very, very quickly. And as someone who is renovating a house right now, I can attest to that 20% rise in home building costs. And all my builders will tell me that the cost of finding timber or just finding timber full stop is very difficult. And therefore, of course, it becomes more costly. And they quickly pass that price rise on to me. So I understand. But at the same time, you're kind of also forgetting the fact that some prices have actually gone down. So we would have seen, for example, some household equipment prices go down. So think about, obviously, IT equipment, solar panels, that sort of thing. There are actually things, believe it or not, that move the other way. We don't tend to think of those, though, so much because we don't tend to buy them very often. So they tend to be the less frequent purchases. And so we get less excited by the price of those things changing. If, we're paying our childcare bill, for example, every week and that was going down every week, we'd probably get pretty excited by that. But of course, it's not. It's going the other way. Whereas the TV that you buy once, maybe every 3, 4, 5 years, that price is probably coming down. And you're getting a better quality TV for the same money. And that has to be counted as well because, we're talking like for like here. So if you're getting better quality, then you're technically buying a better product and it would cost more normally. But of course, if it's coming down in price, then you're getting a double bonus there.
So you think psychologically people that are only looking at what's going up, what they see on a regular basis, regular purchases, grocery, petrol, alcohol, those sort of issues, rather than bigger ticket items that they're not purchasing as frequently?
That's often the case, and that's why psychologically it doesn't feel representative, I think, of what we're forking out every week. The other big one, of course, is house prices. So the cost of buying an existing home feels astronomically expensive for most of us, and that isn't reflected in the CPI. And I think that's something else that means that people don't perceive the CPI to be very accurate as to what they're spending.
Would you put it into the CPI?
No, I wouldn't, because it's not a reflection of what we're trying to capture in the CPI, and it's also not in line with international standards, so we'd get ourselves into all sorts of complicated trouble there from the statisticians. We wouldn't want that. But the other thing is, it is an asset price. It is an appreciating asset. It belongs in a different category, if you like. That's not to say we shouldn't, of course, put that into the mix when we're thinking about policy and we're thinking about how to deal with some of the problems that we're facing. It's clearly very important to include it there. But in terms of actually putting it into the CPI, it's not really particularly.
So in dealing with inflation, if I'm a household, I've got four options in trying to cope with increased prices. I can change my purchasing habits so that I can afford the same basket of goods, but I'm not getting as many goods in my basket, if you like. It's the first thing I could do. I could dip into my savings and continue to buy exactly what I've been buying before and finance it through my bank account. I could wait every 12 months and see if the government's going to be kind to me and give me some money from their budget, which is what they've just done in terms of handouts. The last thing I could do is I could ask my employer for a wage increase to compensate me for the increase in CPI. And there's this economic term called the wage price spiral, which is all to do with inflation. Could you just talk a little bit about the wage price spiral?
Yeah, and it can go up or down as spirals can do. So let's say we see, as we are at the moment, the prices of the goods and services that we purchase regularly going up, and petrol is an obvious example here, and we're feeling the pinch, and we have some bargaining power with our employer, then we can ask the employer to compensate us for that extra expenditure that we have to make to essentially remain the same. So in other words, we're not getting any more for our money, it's just costing us more. So the employer, depending, of course, on who he or she might be able to replace us with, may say yes or no. And if they say yes, then you do tend to get an increase in wages. And then when you put wages up, of course, that makes expenses more problematic for the employer in the sense that their costs go up. They start putting the prices up, and then you get into the spiral. Yeah, as you can see that the prices of the goods that they're producing need to go up. The consumer, also the worker, needs more money to pay for those, and you're back into the same cycle again. That's it in a nutshell. And it also can work the other way in the sense of when things are weak, but we tend to see it more on the upside.
Okay, so you've got increase in wages that the employer who's producing a good or a service has to pass that on. That creates inflation. We're giving the worker more money so he can go out and buy more things, and it can keep on going, can't it?
It can, yes, that's right. And in the past, we have definitely seen examples of that. I think what's happened recently, though, is that for whatever reason, that wage link hasn't been as strong. So in other words, when we're seeing activity in the economy pick up, the wages don't necessarily go with it. And there's a number of reasons for that. There's structural reasons, there's globalization reasons. So when you think about the labor market these days, you know, we are competing, we as workers are competing with those offshore more than we used to. You know, even economists like myself can quite easily be hired in a different country on a lower wage if the employer sort of doesn't see much difference in the ultimate benefit that they're getting. And so, you know, we are competing with those who are willing to work for less than us. The structural changes may be around the makeup of the labour force, the unionisation of the labour force, enterprise agreements. One factor which has been particularly important of late has been state governments who have been putting wage caps on their employees. Now, state governments employ a lot of Australian employees. In fact, I think around a third. And that, therefore, when they've got, you know, 1.5-2% wage caps, has a big influence on the Australian labour market as a whole.
Okay, right. At the moment, we're pretty close to what I would call economic nirvana. We've got inflation running 3-5%. I don't think statistics can ever be exact. We've got some wage growth. Mm-hmm. We've got full employment. So what's created inflation this time around? And whose responsibility is it to fix inflation?
So we have inflation this time around for a number of reasons. As always, these things don't tend to be driven by just one factor. So at the moment, we've got a number of things going on. We've got the oil prices. Global oil prices obviously have risen. They've also fallen and risen, and they've been quite volatile, but they've certainly on an upward trend, as we know, in recent months. We've got the stimulus that's in both the domestic economy, so in the Australian economy, as well as international economies, because of COVID. So the recovery and I guess the emergency support that had been put in place by our government and governments around the world has created a lot more money in the economy. And that money, of course, has generated activity, and the activity has generated demand for labour. And there is some increase in wages coming through with that, and there's also some price increases coming through with that. At the same time, of course, we've had this terrible situation in Ukraine, which has blocked the supply of a number of important commodities that we and most of the rest of the world rely on, whether or not we buy them from Russia and Ukraine or from other countries, but it certainly tightened the supply of wheat and oil and gas in particular. And because there's less supply, we are seeing, of course, people bid up the price for that. And that's caused, as we know, the petrol price situation to get worse, as well as pushing up food prices. And then, as if that's not enough, we've also had, of course, the recent floods in Queensland and New South Wales, which have destroyed many crops. And that, too, is putting upward pressure on prices of some foods because, of course, again, it tightens the supply. And when you tighten the supply, people have to pay more if they would like it. And that's quite inflationary. So all these things have come together, and in quite a short space of time, and quite concentrated. And so that's why we're seeing inflation suddenly back in the headlines.
How transitory do you think all these factors are? Are they here just for a short time, or are we looking at inflationary pressures because of the wage price spiral that you talked about before, where all of a sudden, to compensate for these quite immediate price increases, we're having to compensate wage earners? And then it kicks off the spiral? Or do you think this is something that is short-lived?
I think the answer is somewhere in between, and I don't mean to be a vincitor here. I think some of the factors will be short-lived. So if we think about, for example, the global supply blockages, I guess, that we've had in the last 2 years caused largely by COVID and the fact that people were demanding a lot of goods over services. And so we had this sort of surge in demand for goods. That should settle down. Two reasons would be because people are more adjusting back to the normal balance of goods versus services. And so the extreme demand for goods should settle down a bit. At the same time, you've got those that can supply shipping services, for example, actually putting more capacity into the market, more containers are being built, more shipping lines, more operations. And of course, as COVID comes out of the equation and people can operate commerce a bit more normally, then that doesn't create problems. So the kinds of price increases that we've been getting because of that reason should dissipate. There's no reason to expect that they wouldn't. The global oil price has been going up very sharply, and to continue to produce inflation, it would have to continue to be going up. Now, I'm certainly not calling the top of the oil price spike, but we wouldn't expect it to continue to increase at the rate that it has been. So if oil prices remained high but didn't actually grow anymore, then that would, I guess, cease to become a reason why inflation continues to move up. There are other factors, though, that make me think some of these price rises will certainly continue. And as you say, this wage price spiral idea is probably at the core of that. We would expect to see some push up in wages. Whether or not it is substantial is a very difficult question to answer. But for the reasons I was explaining before, that wages just don't rise as quickly as they used to in the past, makes us think, yes, we'll see some increase in wages, but it's not going to be ridiculous, and it's probably not going to get away from us. So you can see there that there are some factors that would keep inflation moving along and continuing to just potter along and at a rate that we haven't been used to, so a bit higher. But there's some factors that definitely should fall out of the equation and may even have a temporary deflationary impact on prices too. Mm-hmm. We haven't mentioned so far also the government's budget measures, including the temporary reduction in the fuel excise. Now, that is something that is going to have a very short-term decrease on prices, potentially, and I'll come back to that in a minute. But then when the fuel excise goes back to normal, then it actually causes prices to jump again. The same thing happened when the government put in place free childcare during COVID. We had a very quick downward movement in prices because the cost of childcare, well, essentially became free. And then, you know, equally it went back up again. So some of these forces are very deliberately temporary and put in place by government.
If it's costing me an extra $2,060 per year because of the price of fuel to fill my 60-litre tank, the government's contributing $686 toward reducing that. So it's still leaving $1,300 there. Let's get to the bad guys. The bad guys are the people that are going to try and reduce inflation when it happens, and it's the Reserve Bank and the government, monetary policy and fiscal policy. Please explain how the Reserve Bank will try and keep a lid on inflation, because their mandate, well, what is the Reserve Bank's mandate? Everybody wants to have a different view of it, whether it be keeping full employment or keeping interest within a certain range. But they're signalling that they're going to increase interest rates. So they're doing that because they want to keep inflation down. So tell us a bit about the mechanisms that they can use to do that.
Well, first of all, I have to disagree with you. The Reserve Bank are the bad guys. What they're actually trying to do is to maintain a strong financial system, keep the currency stable, keep full employment. It's just that sometimes the only way that they can do that is to increase interest rates.
I guess I probably didn't mean that they're bad guys from my point of view, but certainly they're the government like to call them bad guys, depending upon where you are in the election cycle, and householders would probably call them the bad guys when they start to increase cash rates. But all of
that's right. Sure, it feels like they're the bad guys. That's very true. That's very true. So you're right. The Reserve Bank will use monetary to try and fix inflation. So just by law, the Reserve Bank, as I said, is actually required to to keep the currency as stable as possible, to keep full employment as much as possible, and to promote the economic prosperity and welfare of the Australian people. It does that by meeting a medium-term inflation target, which at the moment is 2-3%, and always has been since it's been in place, and I don't see that changing. And it also, of course, in the background is working to maintain the strength of the financial system and an efficient payment system too, which are really important parts of its task. In practice, it does that by changing the cash rate, which is, I guess, the benchmark interest rate in the market. And it's the rate at which all other market interest rates move off, whether they be bank to bank, bank to consumer, short-term mortgage rates, credit card rates, they all are essentially anchored off this cash rate. It's not a perfect relationship, and you'll remember through the global financial crisis when we saw the banking sector increase interest rates when the Reserve Bank wasn't, so it's certainly not a one-for-one, but essentially that is the benchmark, and it's a very powerful influence on financial markets. So of course, when they see prices rising, their one policy tool is to increase the cash rate and slow down demand in the economy by taking a little bit of money out of our pockets as we repay our mortgages, a little bit more money than we had taken out last month anyway. And in doing so, it's, I guess, taking some of the what they'd see froth out of the economy and starting to cool the economy, which should also cool.
Okay, so they're also the entity that participated in quantitative easing, which was injecting $3.8 billion of new fresh money into the Australian economy every week. And that was because the cash rate wasn't really working. It was the lowest it would have ever been, came down to zero, which is basically technically where it is, you know, at the moment. They did, again, what certainly through my generation was the great fearful thing that any central bank would do, was print money. That's going back to the black and white photo of the lady stuffing her stove full of banknotes and boiling the kettle using the flames from the notes rather than from the wood she couldn't afford. In 2008, when we had the Great Recession, they reduced the cash rates down to nothing. In many countries, they had negative cash rates, so you would be paying a bank to hold your money in their accounts to capitally protect it. But they printed money, and now they've said they're going to stop to do that. We're ceasing quantitative easing.
Done with that.
Yeah. And we're going to slowly increase rates. So that's throwing water on what they regard as an economy that may be overheating. So that's their viewpoint, and they're an independent organisation.
Indeed, yeah.
But then we've got the government through fiscal policy, which is a fantastic Latin term for just spending money or not spending money.
Or not, yeah.
And they've decided to spend $80 billion of money that they don't have out of this last budget. And that would increase economic activity, wouldn't it?
Yes, but the deficit is $78 billion, or projected to be $78 billion next financial year. Of course, we never really know until we get there. But last year it was, the current financial year, it's $79.8 billion, which means that the deficit is actually smaller next year than this year, which means that relative to the last budget update, it's actually mildly, very, very mildly tighter policy. So, yes, we have a government that's got an expansionary fiscal policy in the sense that there's a deficit and they're basically putting more into the economy than they're taking out as a sector. So the government's putting more cash into the economy than it's subtracting through taxes and the other ways that it does. But of course, part of the reason for that is because of COVID, and we're in particularly unusual circumstances, and the size of the deficit is particularly large because of that. what really matters is what they do with that from here. And the fact that they have projected to get back to a smaller deficit faster is actually kind of news, reflecting the fact that the economy is picking up and they feel like they can do a bit less. Could that deficit have been much smaller than $78 billion? Absolutely. And could it be less deflationary on the economy? Yes. But I'd say that they're kind of heading in the general correct direction. I would like to have seen them actually not spend any of the what we've been calling the windfall gains from a stronger economy that made that deficit smaller. And that $78 billion deficit could have been, you know, something closer to 60 had they not done that. But generally, they're heading in the right direction.
Okay. Now, the Bergonomics podcast previous guest, who is Associate Professor Stephen Hamilton of the George Washington University, we were talking about the sanctions against Russia. He believes the Australian Treasury Department's forecast of inflation peaking at 4.25% and then in 3 years decreasing. In other words, he's saying that the Treasury Department is forecasting deflation in 3 years. He believes that this is illogical because we've got so much money in household savings. We've got people that haven't been able to spend money because they've been locked down due to COVID. There's government budget handouts in this current budget, and we've got increasing wages. So he only sees inflation going up and up and up. We see the Reserve Bank probably agreeing with him, going, we need to throw some cold water on this, yet we see a government going, we're going to hand out some money. There's a conflict here, isn't there? It is the government trying to make voters happy with handouts, and then the RBA is then trying to take them away with higher interest rates or potentially higher interest rates?
Yeah, it is. It certainly on the surface, it looks like that, doesn't it? And you know, that as I said before, I think that the government could have spent less in this budget. It's not particularly welcome from the Reserve Bank at the moment for some households to be getting a $250 cost of living payment, and other households, when they finish the tax return this year, getting another $450 when they submit their tax return. And to the extent that we're adding, you know, $1.5 billion into the economy from those social security pension holders, $250 payments, and for the low and middle income tax recipients, another $4.1 billion. So that's, you know, essentially that's money in the economy, $5.6 billion that the RBA would rather not there at the moment because they are on the cusp of raising interest rates. It's important, though, to also ask the question, is it a big enough sum of money to actually realistically cause the Reserve Bank to be acting differently from what it would have been before? And what I'm trying to say here is that the reason the RBA are lifting rates is we're kind of already baked in the cake. This doesn't help, no, and I don't think the RBA, had they had control of fiscal policy as well, would have done the same. But that sum of money is the equivalent to around about 6 weeks worth of spending on cafes, restaurants, and takeaway food in the Australian economy. It's not huge. It's not a massive part of consumption. It's not a massive part of household income. I don't realistically think it's going to completely change the way that the Reserve Bank goes about lifting rates. The RBA were going to be lifting rates anyway. They're normalizing the interest rate. They are lifting it from what is an exceptionally low level, as you say, practically zero, to something that's more sustainable and more appropriate for the economy in this stage of the economic cycle. This fiscal impact, as I say, not great, but not a game changer.
Okay. Just before we get on to my favourite topic, we're currently at 4% unemployment. And they're saying that it's going to go down to 3.8% unemployment. So we are at full employment. That's the definition of full employment is 4%.
Roughly, yeah. And it changes, but roughly, yes.
Okay. I'm sure that there are so many of our listeners that are scratching their head now going, hang on, Why can't full employment be 0%? Why is full employment roughly 4%? What's the 4%?
Well, it's quite a simple answer here. It's essentially people who are moving between jobs. So it's called frictional unemployment. At any one time in the economy, as you can imagine, you have people moving in and out of the labor force. I'm only 3 weeks into my new role. There was a period of a week there where I decided to take off a holiday, so to speak. I left my old job and I didn't start the new one till a week later. For that week, I was unemployed. I was frictionally unemployed. And that's just normal behavior throughout the economy. It happens all the time. And it's something that we've been observing for a while. So it's quite a straightforward answer, that one.
So what you're saying is that of those people that qualify to be employed, 4% of them at any one time are in between jobs.
Just moving around. Yep, that's right. So frictional unemployment. Now, of course, as you said before, statistics are not that perfect that we can say that that's the exact number, but that is roughly what we're measuring.
Okay. Now, the US, they're going through inflation, a little bit more pointed than our inflation is, but not much, just a bit more. Mm-hmm. And to quell their inflation, it would seem that everyone in the US is predicting 10 interest rate rises, each of 0.25%, all within 12 months. So they're saying the cash rate in the US is going to go up 2.5%. And in Australian terms, if I was the average mortgage holder of a home, which is about $600,000 at the moment, that's an extra $15,000 per annum. After tax, that I would not have to spend on other things. That's a pretty dramatic amount of money, but that's the US experience at the moment. Now, without getting into this great technical discussion about bond yields, bond yields are predictors of what's going to happen in the future. I like to think of them as funnels. You get all this information, all this disparate economic information, financial information, investment information, global trading information. And considering that the bond markets dwarf the size of all the equity markets around the world, all this information is put into this big funnel and it pops out these things called bond yields. And let's not worry too much about how all some things are calculated. But the Australian government 3-year bond yield, which is basically a prediction about where the bond traders think interest rates are going to be in 3 years, that bond yield has gone up 2.4% in the last 9 months. And the bond traders are predicting it's going to go to 3%. If that was to flow through to the cash rate, of which it would, if it's correct, and bond traders traditionally are pretty correct, and then that cash rate flows through to mortgage rates, of which they invariably do, that means that in 3 years' time, the average Australian mortgage holder of $600,000, he's going to have to find $18,000 extra per year after tax just to fund the same house he's living in. That's an astronomical amount of money. And then if I read today's Financial Review, there are 36 bank economists who on average believe that by December 2024, that the cash rate will be slightly less than that, 2.28%, that's $13,680 per year more, or $263 per week more for the average mortgage holder to find. If we look somewhere in between $13,600 and $18,000 a year, that's one mighty big wage increase everyone's going to be screaming out for just to maintain their own standard of living that they're currently enjoying. Otherwise, that's a lot of goods and services that are not going to be bought and not be produced. And you'd have to say that the country would go into a recession and possibly a housing crash?
Well, I think there's a couple of things I'm going to bring into this discussion. One is that interest rate that the bank economists and the bond traders and the markets more generally are predicting by December 2024 is not unrealistic. You're right. And it does tend to, that market does tend to preempt what will happen in many ways with the cash rate. But if economic circumstances change, that number would also change. So in other words, if the economy started to slow down or let's say fiscal policy was tightened remarkably for whatever reason, and that was crunching the economy, that would change. So these are very fluid numbers, as first thing I'd point out. Mm-hmm. A lot can happen, of course, between now and the end of 2024. The second thing is the Reserve Bank is not sitting in isolation deciding that it's going to put rates up at a uniform rate for a certain amount of time just to get back to something that it considers normal. It will watch the data very closely every month, of course, ahead of its interest rate board making decision time, and it will assess the economy accordingly. And if it sees too many households starting to feel the pinch, then my bet is that it would take its foot off the brakes, because at the same time, we'd probably be seeing pressures on wages and inflation. The third thing I'd point out is that we are in a very unusual times in the sense that the cash rate is 0.1%, as we've said a couple of times. That is an exceptionally low interest rate. It's essentially, it doesn't cost any money to borrow money at the moment. And it's generally not sustainable in an economy which is actually recovering as quickly as ours is from COVID. So it isn't suitable, although it's painful for some households to hear this, of course, it isn't suitable that money is this cheap at the moment, because essentially what would happen is we'd still get those continued renovations happening and people would still go out and bid for house prices and they'd push them up. And that's not where we want to be either. So we need the Reserve Bank in some ways to be sort of cooling the economy from that point of view, although acknowledging, of course, that they don't directly target house prices. And another point I'd make is that households are sitting on savings that they've basically never seen before because of the money that the government put into the economy through the COVID 2 years. So lots and lots of government payments there. And people weren't spending them because a number of reasons. They were feeling a bit cautious. They couldn't spend them on services. And and the Treasury will say this, we essentially wanted to put more money into the economy than COVID took out. So in other words, households and businesses sitting on strong balance sheets. And another point I'd make is that, and this is straight from Governor Lowe at the Reserve Bank, households are sitting well ahead on their mortgage rate. So in other words, they could, they don't necessarily need to be increasing their mortgage repayments straight away. They have some time to adjust to those higher rates because most households, I think it's about 2 years ahead on their payments. So in other words, the average household, and of course this is not the same for everyone, but the average household's sitting pretty right now. They've got good savings. They're ahead on their mortgage repayments. They've sort of had it pretty good because of the government payments that have been going into the market. And so increasing interest rates should be able to be handled fairly well by most households. I think in the position that they're not, or when the case comes that they're not, the Reserve Bank would act accordingly. And the Reserve Bank, of course, is not going to deliberately crunch the economy. They've done that in the past and they've learned their lesson. Mm-hmm. They will be taking it easy.
Well, let's talk about when they did that in the past, because they did do that and it created a situation in the Australian economy that, well, to put it a different way, one of my economics professors at university used to say the only thing that caused the famed economist Keynes to drink too much wine was stagflation, because he couldn't find any simple answers to the concept of stagflation, which was high inflation and high unemployment. And that's the situation that you just described before, that the Reserve Bank previously, once in the 1970s, which unfortunately I do remember, they caused stagflation. And everybody sat around for years going, I don't know what to do. I've got no idea. You know, we've dug a hole and we were a listless, aimless economy. Do you think that that could happen?
Look, it is the stuff of nightmares because, as you say, the normal policy tools don't work, and Keynesian theory starts to unravel when you've got stagflation. Look, I would say that there's not a 0% possibility that this doesn't happen. And the reason for that is often stagflation is occurring because there is a supply shock in the economy, which is lifting prices. And that is what we've got at the moment. In other words, we've got an oil price spike. At the same time, I'll go back on that. We have an oil price shock at the moment, and that's causing higher prices. If for whatever reason the economy was to slow down at the same time, then we'd be in a stagflation situation. The thing is, at the moment, of course, the economy isn't slowing down. If anything, it's going along at a pretty reasonable pace. Mm-hmm. And so as long as that continues, and of course we avoid the stagflation situation, so you'd have to put a low probability on it. So I'd say less than 5%, but you certainly wouldn't say no probability. But of course, you know, the central banks, policymakers, we've learned from the past, and you know, hopefully it is something that we can avoid going forward.
I think that if there's $1.3 trillion worth of home mortgages, both homeowner and investment mortgages out there, and you put up interest rates 1%, and that equals additional interest payments of $13 billion, that's going to put a big, big dent in the economy in terms of spending, goods and services. But I mean, people, you take $18,000 out of someone's bank account for 1 year.
That's a lot, right? Yeah.
They're psychologically, you know, there's this thing is the stuff of another podcast called The Wealth Effect. Everybody feels so fantastic. My house has doubled in value. I'm an electrician. I'm earning the same amount of money as my local GP. I'm going to go and buy a new Ford Ranger because they look good. Life is wonderful. They're suffering what's called the wealth effect. All of a sudden, you say, okay, give me $18,000 a year straight after tax. That hurts psychologically. That changes the game. Do you think that can happen?
Look, I the problem is it doesn't happen as an $18,000 payment out of their budget. It would be to those very clever people who sit there and budget and work it all out. But the average punter, I'm guessing, doesn't do that. And it also comes gradually, so you don't sort of lose the $18,000 all at once. It's, you know, it's a series of slow interest rate increases. They're very well flagged, I would say, as well. So I think most households be aware that they're coming and they need to start adjusting slowly. And as I said, the fact that, you know, we've actually financially anyway had it pretty good for the last 2 years. And importantly, that pretty much everyone that wants a job has got one. That's hugely, I think, means that we won't feel as bad as you might in that situation if you just take $18,000 out of someone's household budget for the year. But, you know, the monetary policy is trying to do just that. It is trying to slow the economy and taking money out of people's pockets because they have to pay more on the mortgage. It shows up. There is no doubt about it.
Now, Sherrill, now we get to the fun bit of the podcast, okay? Mm-hmm. This is when you, as our first female economist, gets to explain the concept of inflation through a hamburger. And we do this because everybody relates to hamburgers. So if we hold up a hamburger and we say we've got inflation, the sort of inflation that we're talking about today, tell me the effects on the hamburger and why.
Okay, well, I'm a bit of a Friday night takeaway person. I'm usually pretty exhausted by the end of the week and, you know, cooking for myself, kids, it's no fun. So I'm thinking about the takeaway. I'm thinking about the hamburger. And I'm driving to the hamburger joint with my family, and I've noticed that the price of a hamburger has gone up from $6 to $7 because beef prices have gone up. I've been talking about some of the reasons for that. The problem is, of course, I haven't had a pay rise. And so I, you know, I look back at my two kids in the back of the car and I sort of think, oh, how are we going to get around this problem? And I sort of work it out in my head and I realize that I can really only afford three hamburgers, not four hamburgers. I can't afford chips for everyone. So I'm telling my youngest that they don't get a hamburger. They can only have the chips. And that the reason why is inflation. They may not like that, but that's my economics explanation.
I think that's fantastic. How old are your children? Maybe they can start introducing the word inflation at school.
I've got 12-year-old twins, so and they do like to sprout back economics at me.
And I'll be using that against you.
Indeed, that's right.
Cheryl, thank you very much for demystifying inflation for us. You've done a wonderful job. Enjoy your career at EY. They're a terrific firm. And I'm sure you'll be able to help all of their clients understand the importance of economics, which is probably the Bergenomics podcast mission, is for people to understand what a fantastic social science that it is. And if more people understood it, more people could feel more empowered about their own lives, and it's not something to feel threatened about. And inflation is something that I feel is going to start to make people feel uneasy. And you, with your descriptions, will make them feel not as uneasy as maybe they would have, because now they understand it better. So thank you very much.
Great. Thank you. And and here's to all those female economists that you're going to have in your podcast in future, because there's many good ones out there.
Well, I'm looking forward to having lots and lots and lots of them. So, because, yeah, I think it's... I don't know if you know, but the Reserve Bank did a recent study where they basically said that a lot of people aren't studying economics, and the female component is falling away quicker than the male component, which I think is a real shame. And so I really want to encourage females to look at economics as it's just a way you can take and change the world. I mean, if it's financial markets, if it's sustainability, carbon, any area that you want to in life, economics can make a positive contribution. And if you want to change the world, economics is the way to do it.
Indeed, absolutely it is. And it's not all about share markets and bond yields. It's, as you say, there's many, many applications for economics. And we tend to find that women are more interested in the types of careers where they can really do some good in the world. And, you know, if you want to do some good, then get some economics under your belt, I say.
Absolutely. Thank you very much for joining us.
Pleasure. Thank you for having me.
My thanks to those who made today's podcast possible. My guest, Cheryl Murphy, EY's Chief Economist for Oceania. I really enjoyed Cheryl's balanced viewpoints, allowing everyone to better understand the factors at play with inflation, especially as it is a topic that generates strong opinions. Also, thank you to Ology Creative for their design inspiration, and Bergenomics' new marketing and media partner, Sue Tonks from Oliver & York, who, due to our growing audience, are providing social media and public relations support for the Bergenomics podcast. Bergenomics has some fascinating topics coming up that we economically demystify, exposing the reality that will affect you: electric cars, net carbon zero, and Liberal versus Labor, who will make you wealthier. So you don't miss out, please hit the Bergenomics subscribe button on your podcast channel and follow Bergenomics Podcast on Twitter, Instagram, and LinkedIn.